The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello.
Hello, fellas.
Happy New Year. Oh, no, we did that last week.
Well, you haven't wished Happy New Year to Lionel, so go ahead.
Happy New Year, Lionel.
Happy New Year, Daniel.
Happy Hogmanay.
Lovely.
We discussed that last week. We probably won't revisit that topic.
My word.
No, we've done that.
I was looking at our listener data, and we've lost 90% of our Scottish listeners after last week.
Well, I'm hoping you've come back from De Koonink with an Ali Hodge interview, Lionel, to try and win them back.
Unfortunately not, because he wasn't there. He was already on his way to Argentina for his first race of the season.
I think he was in Scotland for Hogmanay, wasn't he? So
Ali's Army. A perfect opportunity to play Ali's Tartan Army, the 1978 Scotland World Cup theme. Of course, that World Cup was played in Argentina. It's absolutely perfect. Maybe we'll try and secure the rights to that for next time.
Yeah,
Hodge wins a race.
Old Ali Hodge wouldn't even have been born when the World Cup was in Argentina. But anyway.
What about wee Jimmy Johnson? We didn't mention him last week, did we?
Oh, God.
My dad used to talk about him a lot. Anyway, go on, carry on. Carry on. Cycling. Cycling season.
Well, Lionel, you're back from De Koonink. You weren't happy with our pronunciation of De Koonink last week. Would you like to put more of a U in it?
It's more De Koonink. De Koonink, I gather.
De Koonink, okay. It kind of sounds like it sounds like a verb, the gerund of a verb, meaning something like, I don't know, when a third world economy has a rush on, when there's a rush on gold prices or something. De Koonink.
Well, did you come back like with having negotiated any kind of bonus for us every time we mentioned De Koonink?
No, but my new windows are lovely. I'm joking, of course. No.
Excellent. Well, you're going to tell us a bit more about your time with De Koonink later in the episode, I think, in the final part of the episode, in part two. I'm getting confused now about which part is what, but I think you've got an interview with Caleb Ewan, Daniel, from training camp that you were at, Lotto Soudal, before Christmas. He obviously is in action in Australia at the moment at the Tour Down Under. But before any of that, Lionel, do you have a news roundup, please?
I do indeed, Richard. Yeah, it's good you mentioned Caleb Ewan, because he won the People's Choice Classic, the curtain raiser criterium to the Tour Down Under at the weekend. His first race and first win for Lotto Soudal after moving from Mitchelton Scott. Off the mark, but not off the mark in the World Tour yet as we speak. The Tour Down Under got underway a couple of nights ago. Elia Viviani of De Koonink Quickstep won the first stage, his first World Tour race of the year, first victory in a World Tour race of the year. His last race of last year was the final stage of the Vuelta in Madrid, which he also won, so literally picking up where he left off. And as we speak, the second stage of the Tour Down Under has also been held, and the New Zealand time trial champion Patrick Bevin won to give CCC their first victory in their new orange jerseys. Or the jerseys are the same as they were when they were CCC before, but of course now they're a World Tour team, no longer BMC Racing, of course. So he will be swapping the orange CCC jersey for a slightly darker ochre orange jersey as leader of the Tour Down Under. The race continues until the weekend. The Women's Tour Down Under has already concluded. Amanda Spratt won a stage and clinched the overall there. Australian riders won three of the four stages, with Grace Brown and Chloe Hosking also taking victories. At first clarification corner, or corrections corner of the year, last week we talked about the quite remarkable story of the 90-year-old Carl Grove, who was US Masters champion on the track in the 90 to 94 year age group before testing positive. Just to clarify, we were talking about, you know, why would resources go into testing a rider who was the only competitor in his category. Should have clarified that the reason he was tested was because he'd set a world record time for that age group, not just because he'd beaten nobody in the races. A bit more sort of doping news. unfortunately, Jani Brakovic has been banned for 10 months after testing positive for methylhexanamine. The UCI accepted that the substance was in a contaminated supplement that he'd taken, hence the short ban. The 35-year-old Slovenian rode for Discovery Channel, Astana, Radio Shack and Bahrain Merida. His biggest win was the 2010 Dauphiné. Last year he was riding for the Slovenian Adria Mobil team, which is the same team he started his career with. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because he wrote quite a powerful blog on his website explaining the circumstances, or explaining how he sees the circumstances that led to this positive test. And in it he talks about having been bullied during his career, feeling that he didn't fit in, feeling that he was got the rough end of the stick because he wasn't prepared to dope as much as others, is the implication that I'm reading into that. He also said that during one tour, he was choked by a teammate, told he was zero, nobody, worthless. Quite a powerful and troubling blog, really, if anyone wanted to check that out on Jani Brakovic's website. Bit more doping news. In a way, confirmation that the ban on the painkiller tramadol will come into effect on March the 1st. We had long anticipated this, but the UCI have confirmed that March the 1st, that's the first day that tramadol will be on the banned list. And finally, the former Team Sky and British cycling doctor Richard Freeman faces a medical misconduct trial in Manchester early next month. Some of the pre-hearing reports have been posted on the General Medical Council's website regarding the hearing. Dr. Freeman is alleged to have ordered 30 sachets of a testosterone product called Testogel from a company called Fit for Sport Limited. The products were delivered to Manchester Velodrome in May 2011. In October of that year, Dr. Freeman is alleged to have written to Fit for Sport requesting that they send him an email confirming that the order had been sent in error. The allegation is that Freeman knew this to be false. The other key allegation is that the product was intended for an athlete. Now, the tribunal will obviously test all of this evidence in a hearing that could last as much as a month. The decision should be published 28 days after that, so we should be a little bit clearer on this story by late March, I guess. But really troubling that these allegations are so stark, and of course, you know, there are no grey areas when it comes to a substance like testosterone, are there?
There are not. No, this is quite a dark shadow sort of looming, and you know, very troubling indeed. I mean, there was a UK anti-doping investigation into all that had gone on at British Cycling Team Sky involving Dr. Freeman, and it didn't get to the bottom of some of this stuff. And already in you know what they've published about well, the allegations that they've published and which will be investigated during the hearing, they go further than UK anti-doping were able to go. And so I you know, very, very, very troubling indeed. And as you say, Lionel, no grey area at all. Testosterone is cheating, and if they're able to prove that it was intended for an athlete, well, who was it intended for? And you know, what are the implications of this for British Cycling and Team Sky?
I agree, Rich. And this is probably the most troubling, well, sort of shadow of an allegation of all of the allegations and circumstantial evidence that's been sort of collected about Team Sky in the last 3 or 4 years. Some of the stories and rumours and accusations have amounted to nothing really, but this is a very worrying one, particularly when one considers the timing, 2011, spring of 2011, so before Bradley Wiggins' second tilt at the Tour de France, in the same spring or a few weeks before the contentious Jiffy bag was delivered to the Dauphiné, and or allegedly delivered to the Dauphiné, and also a year when Geert Landers, the Belgian doctor who of course is at the centre of a lot of the noise about Team Sky, that was when he was probably at his, if he was influential at all at Team Sky, it was then in that season.
Yeah, just on the detail that has been released prior to this hearing, I mean, the things that leap out to me are a company called Fit for Sport supplying a testosterone product anyway, and the idea of sending anything of that nature that is clearly banned to Manchester Velodrome, home of British Cycling. And, you know, if that was in error, then that was quite a significant error. It's a case that the medical professionals will certainly want to get to the bottom of. I actually had a look at the Fit for Sport website, and I mean, you can't sort of search it amongst the products. They do have testimonies from various sports teams, football clubs, cricket clubs, and so on, providing plenty of, you know, perfectly normal sporting equipment and medications. But yeah, a company that is supplying that kind of stuff, also in a position to supply a banned substance like testosterone, is it's puzzling to say the very least.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor at the Cycling Podcast. There, the kit that we mentioned last week for EF Education First was unveiled at the weekend. Very fetching. Oh, colours are not my strong point. I'm colourblind, although I can tell pink and blue, but there's a sort of, is it a sort of purpley fade into blue and pink? Would that be correct?
Yes, I suppose so, Richard. Yes.
I'm not very good on purple and blue and stuff, but it's certainly eye-catching, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, a kind of tie-dye effect, I guess, or a bit like those thermonuclear t-shirts. Is that what they were called? Hypercolor t-shirts that were popular. That's it.
Global hypercolor.
Popular in the 80s, that used to change colour with heat, basically, body temperature. So it gives a sort of mottledy effect. But no, it's certainly striking. It will stand out in the peloton, I think.
What do you call them? What did you call those things? What do you call those things which were like a picture, usually a beach scene or some kind of tropical landscape made it from sand in a glass frame? What are those things called? Sand frames?
I know what you mean, but can't see where you're going with this.
Kind of reminding me of that, no?
I don't know where you're
That's
going.
That's kind of reminding me of one of those.
Yeah. Well, as well as supplying the kit, Rafa are also making behind-the-scenes films with Education First, and a couple have gone live. One has gone live just as I'm speaking, so I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but the second episode of Gone Racing is now out. That focuses on Lachlan Morton, have a look at that. If you go on rafa.cc, you'll find links to that, or on the Rafa Twitter feed or other social media feeds belonging to Rafa, so check that out. And I forgot. I'm surprised it didn't make your news roundup, Lionel, but we have to mention the Astana run.
Oh, crikey.
Don't we?
Hi, ciao, salam and hola. Our shirts are in the blue collar. We are the only team who were blue before. All the other blue teams is better to ignore. Our leaders of
Goodness.
The gang.
Speaking of teams and doing things that are eye-catching and ear-catching, that was special, I thought.
How many false starts before you actually got all the way through the whole thing without your face going?
Oh, I watched it all.
With sort of embarrassment.
I sat and watched the whole thing. No, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
No.
Well, as the podcast resident hip hop aficionado, I found it a very tough watch. I had the very, very, very strong impression that Lawrence de Vriezer was behind it. Was very much the.
But the funny thing about that is he's a
the mastermind.
He's quite a quiet guy in, you know,
always
shy.
Always a quiet guy.
It looked to me as though he,
you know.
Yeah, it looked to me as though he felt his whole life had been building to tapering to this magnificent point where he was going to stand in front of the camera with Alexander Vinokurov.
I love the bits in the hotel corridor with the Jakob Fuglsang in what looked like a shopping trolley. Almost like they kidnapped him.
Jakob Fuglsang is in his mid-30s, for crying out loud.
I did like the chain rings around the necks, you know, redolent of the Beastie Boys with their stolen VW car badges from the 80s. That was the thing back then, wasn't it? I can just...
Oh, I've accidentally put it on. Sorry about
that. Oh, no, please don't. I can see people strolling around the trendier parts of London with a sort of a 56 or a 58 tooth chain ring on a chain around their necks.
Well, I'd probably go for 32. You know, I'm not quite as capable as I used to be.
I was also absolutely fascinated to discover there's a place called Palestine and a rapper called Snoopy Doggy Dog.
people may not be aware.
I quite like the sweatshirts.
What we're talking about, you're going to have to get on YouTube and search for Astana rap. But it's caused a bit of a sensation on social media, which obviously is the point.
Just to fulfil our contractual obligations, if you check out the Rafa Gone Racing film before you look at the Astana rap, that would be very helpful. Thank you. Anyway, moving on, the racing has started down under, and Caleb Ewan, first outing for his new team Lotto Soudal, got off to a flyer. But we've seen two stages of the Tour Down Under as well. And I'm glad you mentioned there, Lionel, that Paddy Bevin is the New Zealand time trial champion, because one of our listeners wasn't very happy that he didn't run through the New Zealand national titles last week as well.
In June, we barely mention any of the national champions, do we? Because we're previewing the Tour de France. You know, it's just the way the cookie crumbles. Can't do everything.
No, it can't do everything. But anyway, what has marked all three of these races so far, first two stages, Tour Down Under, and the curtain raiser criterium in Adelaide, are crashes. There have been a lot of big crashes. I don't know if you've noticed that. Nathan Haas had a theory about that. He reckoned the heat was partly to blame, that the brakes aren't staying away, and the riders are coming to the finish quite fresh, waiting for the sprint. He says the issue in part is that in the heat our final effort is like a firework with no fuse. More people are fresh, which increases the risk. That's his opinion. But big crashes in all stages so far.
Well, we hear that in major tours, don't we, often, that the first stages are the most dangerous because of that freshness and that eagerness. And I suppose at the start of the racing season, it's exacerbated.
Especially by the fact that it's a World Tour race now, has been for a few years now, I know, but, you know, the stakes are increasingly getting higher. Everyone wants to get off to a fantastic start. First win is the hardest to get, as they say, well, unless you're De Koenig Quickstep, in which case it just comes along as a matter of course, it seems. But, the Tour Down Under, I'm not going to fall into the usual trap of saying it's the pre-season set friendly of the season, because clearly, from watching the way that, you know, Patrick Bevan it pulled off that win for CCC, you know, this is now an absolutely top level race being contested by everybody, just as much as the Grand Tours almost.
And Viviani looked extremely sharp in winning stage one of the Tour Down Under. He's had a bit of track racing over the winter as well, so, you know, he looked like he was race fit and ready to go. Caleb Ewan looked good on the first night, and you, Daniel, met him recently. Big change for him, moving from Mitchelton Scott to Lotto Soudal, from Australian team to a Belgian team. How did you find him?
He seemed in pretty relaxed form, Rich. Interesting. Well, it's going to be an interesting experience for him going to Red Lotto and the Belgian team. Very much a Belgian team. Ewan's gone in there, not taken a big entourage with him. Adam Blythe has come on board really as a lead out man for Caleb Ewan. But it was interesting to observe just some of the groups that had formed at the training camp. The training camp was being held at the Rafa Nadal Centre in Manacor in Mallorca. And Rafa was around, actually. I didn't see him, didn't get a selfie, but he was on the premises. I did notice that a few card schools had broken out among the, or were being played by the Belgian riders, whereas the English-speaking riders, well, Caleb Ewan and Adam Blythe, seem to spend more time on their phones. Don't know if that's indicative of a cultural difference, but I, by all accounts, Ewan is a pretty easy guy to get on with. I don't expect there to be too many problems there as far as his integration is concerned. One slight issue that he might have, and we actually spoke about at the training camp in Manacor was that he's having to change his coach this year as a result of his move to Lotto Soudal. Previously, he's been working with a gentleman called Kevin Poulton from the New South Wales. Well, previously, he's worked at the New South Wales Institute of Sport. He was also the guy who masterminded Matt Heyman's predominantly Swift-based training before the 2016 Paris-Roubaix, which he subsequently won. Anyway, Ewan has been working with Kevin Poulton. He will no longer be this year, and I spoke to him a bit about that and the coming season.
Well, yeah, I think, to be honest, he's a great coach. But I also think you have to be a certain type of rider to benefit from his training. He's training super hard and super specific, so if you're not 100% committed and 100% follow the program, then it's going to be hard for him to get the benefit out of you. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the guys go from his coaching. But yeah, for me personally, it's been not great, because I've worked probably the last 3 years building a relationship with him. Now I'm changing teams, so that's already a lot of change, and then trying to change coach at the same time is not ideal. But it's what happens, and I think I'm actually pretty easy to adjust to things like that. So, yeah, I'll be fine.
And you say he's training super hard in terms of what, just being relentless, or the rides themselves and the exercises themselves are just super intense?
Yeah, both. He's pretty relentless, and also the actual training days can be super hard. Yeah, but yeah, it's I think he was also coach of Aqua Blue last year, so I know that he coached some of the guys there, and probably some of them couldn't really handle it, and you could probably see it in their performance, it never really got better or anything. So yeah, I think he's a great coach if you can really handle what he's giving you.
So how are you going to replace him?
Well, we have a great coach on the team that does most of the, he's doing the training camp now, and he's doing like all the programs here, so it'd be good to talk to him and discuss training a little bit and see if we'll work well together. Otherwise, yeah, I just have to maybe find another coach.
Have you got fairly clear ideas on sort of what you need to work on, what sort of direction you want to develop in this year, from a kind of physiological point of view?
I think maybe probably my strength a little bit, but that's just kind of always coming with age. Probably need to work on my sprints a little bit more. I think I've gotten maybe a little bit slow not a little bit slower, but maybe I haven't kept increasing like I should have. So
increasing in
speed, right. So I just need to focus back more on sprinting. When I was with my old coach, it was really a lot about endurance, and I felt like maybe I lost a little bit of speed, but now I think I'll focus back more on sprinting, and that's what I'm good at, and that's where I need to be good at to win races. So I'll focus a little bit more on that, and hopefully I can win some more races.
One thing that obviously increases riders' endurance is doing major tours. You haven't done one for a couple of years. You haven't finished one yet. Could there be a bit of an advantage in that as well, though, in that maybe you haven't built up that endurance, but you've also kept some speed that maybe some guys lose when they do two grand tours a year?
Yeah, possibly. You know, I think, like I was saying before, the training that I've been doing with Kev Poulton is bloody hard. So I feel like I've... The endurance that I've done actually so far is almost like doing a grand tour. I mean, I did 15 stages of the Giro when I did it a year ago. So, I mean, the difference between, finishing your 15 stages... I've never finished, so I don't know what the difference is, but I can't imagine it's like a ridiculous difference in your overall performance. I think this year I'll try to... I think if I'm feeling good, I can try to do Giro and Tour, but I think that could really change the rider you are, make you a lot stronger. But yeah, it'd be important to, as you say, keep the speed there as well.
And just finally, Caleb, so this time last year, Mitchelson put out a press release to say you were going to do the Tour de France. Probably a mistake from your point of view, their point of view. But looking back on that year now, do you look upon it as a wasted year or a year where you took important lessons away?
Performance-wise, I think it was a wasted year for sure. I learned a lot. I guess I learned a lot as a person about... This is probably the first time, really, as a cyclist, that I've had to really deal with, like, a really big disappointment and try to come back from that. And I think I did it pretty well. You know, I came back, and I think it would have been easy for me to really just be pissed at the team and not do well or not try at all any of the races. But, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's my career, and I always want to still do well. So... it was a good lesson in that sense, but I think as like performance wise it was definitely a wasted year.
Too few racing days, basically.
Yeah, too few. And I think, I mean, I don't think I'm that bad of a rider that I don't deserve a Grand Tour spot in any of the Grand Tours. So yeah, I think in the end it was the team stuffing me over. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I think they also lost results by doing it, and it's a pity for them as well. And the guys that are sponsoring it, I think the people lower down in management made decisions that they shouldn't have made, and that's just sport in the end, I guess. And it's done now, and now I'm in a team where they're so flexible with my race program, and they really want to give me all the opportunities that I want. So yeah, it's nice being now in an environment like that.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Well, the voice of Seb Piquet there reminds me to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist, of course, is about far more than economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, arts, the environment, and even sport. It helps readers prepare for what's going on in the world around them, and it sifts through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story at a time when facts matter more than ever. The Economist has been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years, and it's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. You can get a free copy of The Economist if you listen to the Cycling Podcast by texting the word cycling, that's C-Y-C-L-I-N-G, to 78070. Not sure I had to spell cycling there on the Cycling Podcast, but I did. Lionel, you've been reading The Economist. Any articles catch your eye this week?
Well, yes, Rich. You mentioned people are always asking questions. Whenever we're on the Tour de France, we're driving around French towns and cities and we see the street names. I'm often asking Francois, why do so many French towns have names, roads named after the same sort of dozen or so historical figures? I mean, every town seemed to have a Place Charles de Gaulle or an Avenue Victor Hugo or a Rue Louis Pasteur or a Rue Jean Jaurès. And the story that...
Rue François Thomason?
Not quite. There might be one in Marseille. Maybe we should name a street after François. Take our own homemade plaque and stick it up on a street somewhere, because this is actually what has been happening in France. There's a push to name more European streets after women. And in France, a Parisian group have been unofficially renaming roads. So there now is a Beyoncé Boulevard. But it's a serious point, this, because most of those roads and streets that are named after historical figures are named after men. And in Paris, 31% of streets are named after men and just 2.6% named after women. And in Brussels, they've been trying to redress the balance a little bit. There were 28 new street names required in this past year, and none of them have been named after individual men. So they've been trying to balance it up a little bit.
My favourite, though, Lionel, because I read this article as well, is the one street has been called This Is Not a Street, an homage to the Belgian surrealist artist René Magritte. I like that. Excellent. Maybe we'll visit the This Is Not a Street when we go to Brussels for the start of the Tour de France this summer.
Yeah, it could be the first corrections corner. We could say, yes, it is. Yes, it is a street. It definitively is a street.
Well, for your free print copy of The Economist, just text cycling to 78070. That's cycling to 78070. Well, Caleb, you and they are quite frank about, you know, missing or at the prospect of not working with his coach, Kevin Poulton. What's happened to him, Daniel?
Kevin Poulton, Rich, will be working for another World Tour team in 2019. Not only that, but he'll be working for one of Ewan's main rivals, one of the guys who's going to be among his main rivals in the sprints. Do you know who it is?
Well, yeah, because this is all a setup, isn't it?
Oh.
Oh, dear.
Can't carry it off.
Oh no! When is Burns night again?
I saw it in the Dropbox folder, so I know we're going to hear from him now.
Well, he's going to be working as a coach for Marcel Kittel and Katusha Alpecin in 2019. But let's hear from Kevin Poulton, because just a couple of days before I spoke to Caleb Ewan, I'd met Kevin Poulton at the Katusha camp, also in Mallorca.
Marcel is doing everything right. He's the consummate professional. I can't fault him at all. In terms of what we're doing now, it really is doing the basics and doing them properly, doing them well. But I guess what I bring to the relationship here is monitoring the fatigue we're building up and knowing when to rest and so on. And look, there's also, I guess there are a few secrets for coaching sprinters in terms of how to keep that leg speed and gain some endurance at the same time. So we've got some new ideas to put to Marcel, and for someone with his experience and the age he's at now to be able to input a new stimulus, a new stress on the body, he's got room to improve, which is pretty exciting.
I was talking to Sam Bennett, the Irish sprinter, a couple of days ago at Bora, and he said that, you know, he's changing his approach slightly in the sense that he's almost going more old school. He's realised that he's got quite a big engine and he's doing less sprint training now and he's doing more volume. But that just sort of shows how the art of sprinting from a physiological point of view and from a training point of view is still very much evolving. You're still sort of trying new things. Everyone is.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. That's probably the simple way to put it. It's a lot of fun, but in some ways the basic rules are quite simple. It's interesting to hear how Sam's training there, but we're doing things a little bit differently. But look, with the sprinters, it really is about being fresh. The more recovered and fresh a sprinter is, the faster they are. But it's that the hard part is that point where they start to lose fitness, and that's what we're trying to do as coaches, to keep the endurance and keep the sprint.
So just finally, Kevin, on Marcel, if there's one key change, significant change that he will be making under you or be making in 2019, what is it?
Oh, that's actually a hard question. One key change. It's not the kind of thing you really want to be putting out there. I'll say we have made some changes and, watch the results.
Well, Kevin Poulton has a big job on his hands, doesn't he, with Marcel Kittel, who is coming off a really bad season. I mean, and Caleb Ewan had a bad season last year. You know, won a bit at the start of the year and then went months and months without winning, and won again at the Tour of Britain. But it was a poor year for him, and as he said to you, Daniel, a bit of a wasted year. But Kittel's problems seemed, because Caleb Ewan obviously had problems with his team. Kittel was in a new team and was quite a marquee signing for Katusha Alpecin and was put in position to win and perform well, but just didn't seem to have it. And a big job, I would think, to turn things around for Marcel Kittel.
I was talking to Patrick Lefebvre at the De Koenig training camp, and he still maintains that Kittel is the best in the world of all the sprinters, but said that Katusha basically just assumed that dropping him into the team would lead to results, and Lefebvre said that wasn't how it worked when Kittel was with their team. They kept the pressure on him. They impressed on him that he had to deliver if they were going to dedicate the team's resources to getting him to the line. And you know, I think that's whether or not, you know, Katusha may dispute that, but because he clearly, you know, not only did he not get the results, but he never looked happy really at the Tour. He was completely out of sorts, and he had already had a bad few months. But it's interesting that they obviously signed him, massive signing for them, and perhaps they did think, we've signed the best guy in the world, and that's all you need to do. And I think there's probably quite a lot more to it than that.
Well, indeed, Lionel. I think there was some confusion and a few misconceptions at the start of last year about what the problem was with Kittel and Katusha. A few people pointed the finger at the lead-out train, and when that really wasn't the issue. The issue was that Kittel was not in form, was not particularly fit when he started the season, and never got fit. And that's been a bit of a recurring theme. Or he certainly had a couple of seasons when issues early on in the season have blighted him then for the rest of the season. So he's someone who needs to really hit the ground running, needs to have momentum straight away, and then is very, very difficult to beat. It's going to be interesting to see how he gets on this year with a few changes. Eric Zabel's come in, obviously was a great German sprinter in his day. He's going to be working alongside Kevin Poulton at Katusha Alpecin. And then as far as Ewan is concerned, I mean, he's going to get a bit of a baptism of fire, I think, at the Tour de France. You know, last year, Mitchelton Scott did make what I think they would probably acknowledge was that mistake of announcing the previous December that he was going to ride the Tour de France. And I don't know whether he rested on his laurels in the spring. He certainly didn't have particularly good results in the spring. He didn't win a lot of races, but I think as the months went by, it became clearer and clearer to Mitchelton Scott that they were going to become even more of a general classification team. And with only 8 riders at the Tour de France, it was going to be difficult to support a sprinter, and they didn't take Ewan. But, you know, that's left him, as we heard in the interview, looking back on a couple of years when he hasn't done Grand Tours. He still hasn't ridden a Tour de France, and you know, it's a bit of a bottleneck as far as the sprinters are concerned going into this season, because there's no obvious dominant figure apart from maybe Viviani. I mean, on the basis of last year, Viviani will be the man to beat, but as you say, Lionel, that's while Kittel is still probably the fastest man on his day.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And a reminder, you can get 25% off with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at the website scienceandsport.com. This week's question for the Science in Sport expert comes from James Jordan. And I think James lives in the US because he says that our friend's coverage is worth every cent he's paid. Thanks for that, James. But he asks the experts at Science and Sport a question about morning nutrition. My problem is feeding early in the morning, as I normally get up and head straight to the trainer before going to work. These sessions normally range from 1 to 1.5 hours, and in terms of intensity are normally in the 8 to 9 out of 10 and require around 900 calories according to my power meter. My problem is feeding before these sessions, as I've never been able to eat any solid food in the first 40 to 50 minutes of waking. If I do eat anything, I can guarantee it will come back up within 10 minutes of consumption. I'm trying to lose weight, so I've only been drinking water with a Science and Sport electrolyte tablet, so no additional calories. My problem is that I'm finding it hard on occasion to finish my final interval, as I'm starting to feel like I just don't have the energy, rather than not having it in the legs. I'm not surprised, James. I'm wondering if I should swap my current drink for one that has more carbohydrates or eat something during the session. Thanks again, James Jordan. Over to you, Ben Samuels.
That's a great question, James. And this is going to be a topic that applies to a lot of us as endurance-focused individuals. Now, the key is going to be balancing both body composition and performance goals over a consistent training block. And looking to achieve both throughout the training weeks is how we get that best outcome. Now, your interval efforts on the turbo are going to be a time to prioritise performance, and in doing that we need to ensure that both calories and carbohydrate are there to maintain workloads throughout the session. The drop in energy and subsequent suffering through those latter intervals is a likely indicator of depleted carbohydrate stores, and having to do this first thing in the morning before breakfast is just going to further compound that issue. For this one, I'd suggest a higher carbohydrate evening meal the night beforehand, then caffeine pre-ride to provide that mental stimulus and get you started through the first couple of intervals. Then, as you suggested, switch to that carbohydrate electrolyte drink during the session. That's going to provide the energy and maintain carbohydrate availability for those latter intervals where you're really starting to see performance declines. In relation to then your body composition goals and weight loss targets that you might have, it's your other days in the week that really become time to target that. So rest days, active recovery spins, the lower intensity sessions are the ones where you can reduce calorie and carbohydrate intake.
Thanks for that, Ben. And a reminder that if you've got a question for the Science of Sport experts, please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, or you can leave a voice memo on the WhatsApp number, which, Lionel, I think you know that off by heart, don't you, the WhatsApp number?
I do, actually. Well, not off by heart, but it's +44 797 133 8205. And if you miss that, well, either just go back 10 seconds on this podcast, or it's in the biog on our Twitter page, cycling_podcast.
Indeed. So please send us your questions. Most of the questions we get are about people's own nutrition, but if you want to ask a question about or even for the professionals, we can endeavour to get those questions answered as well, perhaps by a professional rider. So, yeah, if you've got any questions at all, just send them in. Now, Lionel, you were in Spain last week, an early little Spanish holiday for you in the south of Spain, in Calpe, lovely Calpe. What did you learn at the de Koenig camp?
Well, I learned lots of things, really. There's obviously been a rebranding of the team with a new sponsor coming in, de Koenig. Quickstep has moved back down to the second sponsor slot, which, well, their association with cycling goes back to 1999. They were the co-sponsor of the MAPE team that Patrick Lefebvre managed in 1999. Then they, when Lefebvre left and set up his own team, Quickstep were the sponsor. They had a couple of years as secondary sponsor when Omega Pharma and Etix were the title sponsor, and now they're back in that second slot. Patrick Lefebvre obviously spent a lot of last year talking about the funding gap that he had, knowing that Quickstep were stepping down to the co-sponsorship role. They still get some funding from the Czech gazillionaire, Zdeněk Bakala, but not as significant as it has been in the past, and so they needed an additional sponsor, and de Koenig came in pretty late in the day, and that meant that a few riders left the team, most notably Fernando Gaviria, who went to UAE Team Emirates, basically too expensive for de Koenig Quickstep to keep. Similar story with Nicky Terpstra, who won the Tour of Flanders. Lefebvre would have liked to have kept him, but basically didn't have the budget to do so. And when Direct Energy made an offer, Lefebvre said to Terpstra, well, you better take it because I don't want you to hold it against me if the opportunity slips by, because I can't make you any guarantees. I mean, that could just be smart management. You know, Terpstra is getting on a bit. It might have just been the time to let him go. And there's a touch of the Alex Fergusons about Lefebvre, isn't there? You know, he's been there so long running that team that, you know, he's had generations of riders. The emphasis of the team has always been on winning the classics, winning lots of stages, never really gone for challenging in the Grand Tours. That may well change a little bit with the emergence of Enric Mas, who of course was second in the Vuelta last year and will be targeting the Tour de France with very big personal ambitions this year. He believes he can win it on his debut, which would be a remarkable result. But they've never really had a great impact at the Grand Tours, Lefebvre's team. Lost Max Schachmann, who's gone to Bora Hansgrohe, but the team is still packed with riders who can win, an awful lot of experience. Last year they won 73 races. Philippe Gilbert is still in the team. The old man of the team, still harbouring dreams of winning all of the monuments. Not sure how realistic that is. But for the Cobble Classics, they've got Gilbert. They've got Yves Lampaert, who won Doise d'Or Vlaanderen the last 2 years. They've got Zdeněk Stybar, of course, and Bob Jungels, who'll be having a go at the Cobble Classics for the first time in this team's colours, at least. Then for the sprints, they've got Elia Viviani, who already off the mark this season, and Scotland's finest, Alvaro Hodge. And for the Ardennes, and I guess the Tour de France, Julian Alaphilippe. And that's, you know, not that Alaphilippe's going to win the Tour, but he's certainly, you know, being French, gets them a lot of publicity. He's stage winning potential. And then between Jungels and Alaphilippe, they've got a presence in the Ardennes Classics as well. They've really got all of the bases covered. On the management front, a little bit of a rejig because they have to plug the hole that will be left by Brian Holm, who isn't quite retiring but is stepping back significantly. I gather he'll do around about 50 race days as a sports director this year, but most likely won't do any of the Grand Tours. So I understand that Geert van Bont, Belgian, who has only ridden the Tour de France once as a rider, but he will be put in the team car at the Tour de France. So, you know, subtle changes rather than you know, no big signings this year. But Patrick Lefebvre knows that, having won 73 races last year, that is a target that they're pretty unlikely to match, I would have thought, particularly having lost Fernando Gaviria, who weighed in quite significantly. I spoke to a few riders last week. We'll play a couple of other interviews next week, I think, when those particular riders kick off their seasons in Argentina. But this week we'll hear from Bob Jungels, who is going to ride on the cobbles again this season, not Paris-Roubaix, but he will ride from Omloop Het Nieuwsblad through to the Tour of Flanders. I started by asking him a little bit about why the team and he have come to that decision. And then I asked him about his Grand Tour ambitions, and having finished sixth in the Giro d'Italia in 2016 and eighth in 2017, he focused on the Tour de France last year. And from the outside, it looked like everything was going really well. He was seventh on the cobbled stage to Roubaix at the end of the first week, which meant he was fourth overall going into the first rest day. But gradually things unravelled in the Alps. He lost a little bit of time on the stage to Le Grand Bornand when his roommate Julian Alaphilippe won the stage, and then he lost a bit more at La Rossière and really fell out of contention over that middle week, although he did rally a bit in the final week and finished 11th. Now Jungels, a very thoughtful young man, magnificent hair.
I was going to ask, how was his hair?
I'm obviously,
how was it looking in the off season?
It was looking like a well-risen loaf. It was absolutely magnificent, and you know, I had nothing but envy. It was hard to concentrate on the conversation really without my eyes drifting upwards.
It's difficult, isn't it?
It is, yeah. He obviously puts a lot of care and attention into it, and I wonder whether that's sort of indicative of his
he's immaculate. He's immaculate.
It's a bit glossier than it's a bit shinier than a loaf of bread. It's kind of a loaf of bread with some kind of glaze, Lionel, no?
Exactly right. Yeah, it is. It's magnificent. But he's quite an intense character and obviously thinks very carefully about answering
maybe more like
questions
a brioche type.
Yeah. No, I think a loaf. It's solid.
There's a solidity,
you know, there's no
to
giving it.
It.
But he talked about how basically he wound himself up into such a state at the Tour de France and didn't enjoy the racing at all. The Tour is tense and controlled anyway, and possibly the combination of that and himself feeling tense and controlled led to him perhaps overthinking everything.
I was going to ask about you going back to do some cobbled classics, but I guess the question, turn it around, why have you not ridden the cobbled classics the last number of years? Because obviously under 23 Paris-Roubaix winner, did very well on the cobbles in the Tour last year. Is that part of the reason, because of how well you did last July?
Well, I did ride Roubaix in my first year pro with Radio Shack, but then I felt more attracted to the Danish classics at that time, and to be honest, today I'm very happy that I turned to that. But yeah, also winning Liège last year also showed me that I was actually able to win those monuments. And I talked a lot with Tom Steels at the end of the season, and I don't want to say he convinced me, because it was in my mind. I think I just needed that little push, and I got a lot of confidence from the team riding the Flanders Classics. Yeah, it's kind of a trigger that he maybe released, that I said, okay, I'm gonna do that. But I also say that I'm gonna use this year as an introduction into those classics, because I think, well, the experience in the team is there, but obviously I haven't been around a lot in Flanders recently, so I think yeah, those races you just have to experience more than once to perform at your best. I didn't want to make a 180 degree turn from the Ardennes, so I'm still leaving Roubaix aside. I'm convinced that Flanders is a race that's very close to profile-wise to Amstel and Liège, just with cobbles, which is should actually suit me. Very excited about it.
You said earlier on today how much you enjoy racing in Italy, and you're going back to the Giro where you've done so well in the past. What I'm interested in is what you made of the Tour de France experience last year, going in with a higher profile because of your Giro result, and how the racing in Italy and France compares or differs.
Yeah. Well, after Liège, obviously, I had all the doors were open, wide open. I thought everything was possible, and so I actually put a lot of pressure on myself, maybe training too much, not resting enough. I didn't have that freshness going into the Tour. And then even during the Tour, I didn't enjoy one single day. I was super stressed, and I was not myself in that race. But still, I've learned a lot, I think. Especially this year, I've learned to handle difficult situations, which I haven't had before. So, yeah, it was quite a very important year for myself, just to get to know myself also better. I'm convinced I could have done better in the Tour, but the reason why I'm going back to the Giro is simply the course, is simply the parkour, which, I mean, with the team, three time trials, with a first week that's, I'd say, medium hard, and but like, yeah, there's on every stage there's something that can happen, so it's very much my kind of racing.
From the outside, it looked like the first week, and especially when you rode so well on the cobbles in the Tour de France, it looked like everything was going fine. I'm kind of surprised to hear that you were feeling so stressed and kind of tense about the racing. What was it that kind of got into your head then and made it so difficult?
To be honest, I think it was just the pressure that I put on myself. I was just trying so hard to make that result in a Tour, and I just couldn't relax. I was always worried about the next day and what would happen and what here and there. And yeah, and then I was with Julian in the room, and he was just like, I mean, he smashed it. And that didn't make it easier, because yeah, obviously you want to perform as well. And yeah, so it was kind of difficult to handle all these things, even though I was fourth in GC after the first week. That pressure from that week just fell off, and then, but I couldn't perform in the Alps. And then towards the end, I got my, yeah, like this easiness and this feeling back, and I was attacking in the Pyrenees, and I was, yeah.
That experience at the Tour, do you feel that you have absorbed something from it? You have learned something, and perhaps when you go to the Giro, that you'll be conscious of allowing yourself to relax a bit?
Yeah, I think, well, what I've learned is definitely that I have to see things sometimes a little bit less strict, to be less strict with myself, to respect also the rest periods, and we kind of did that already. We have less racing, much more focused. It's a lot of one-day races, but they're all, like I say, very precisely fixed to deliver, to make results and not just be there. And that's what I'm definitely taking from this year. I want to be at the start again and be there to win that race, and not to see how it goes.
So Bob Jungels there, as you said, Lionel, very thoughtful and measured and a real talent, and always has been, but unclear, you know, what sort of rider he would become. Liège-Bastogne-Liège winner now. Is he through his first couple of Giri, he was mentioned as a, you know, somebody who would develop into a, a three-week stage racer, but I'm not sure. He's just maybe too big a build. Having said that, is he not a similar sort of build to Tom Dumoulin with a similar skill set? And he's still very young as well. You don't know whether it's a blessing or a curse for him being at De Koninck, where there are so many other good riders. But I don't know. The Giro this year will be a chance for him to find his mojo again, I suppose, in a three-week tour.
I think it's tough for him, Rich, in that team. I mean, just listening to the interview, that was the conclusion I drew, really. In that team, I think there is space for a rider who's almost a ready-made and sort of ready-packaged Grand Tour rider to do well. We saw that with Mass at the Vuelta last year. But Jungels is the kind of guy you feel a team needs to make a project of, certainly as far as his Grand Tour ambitions are concerned, almost like Sunweb have done with Tom Dumoulin, who's a similar kind of profile of rider, as well as having similarly magnificent hair. But Jungels, you know, you hear him there talk about needing help at the Tour de France. And, you know, we mentioned last week when we were talking about Dumoulin, how the Sunweb coaches and analysts have, and I'm sure they're not alone, have sort of drilled down into the fundamental differences between the Tour and the other Grand Tours. And, you know, at the Tour, within any given stage, you're having to accelerate, you know, 100 times maybe, as against 40 times in a Giro or a Vuelta stage, just to find your position in the bunch. And what that tells you is that you need, well, there's a lot of that that goes on, moving position, moving up, moving from one side of the bunch to another. And generally, when that's the case, you need teammates, you need people around you to do that. And as we've seen in the last couple of years, that is not what De Koninck now, Quickstep formerly, it's not a team that can afford to go into a Grand Tour with five guys just doing that for Bob Jungels. So I think it's going to be tough for him. And, you know, it was really interesting as well listening to him talk about the Tour last year and rooming with Alaphilippe. And I can fully imagine that was a difficult experience for him, because I think they're very different characters. Jungels is quite intense. I noticed that even at the Dauphiné last year, that he was someone who was certainly very, very determined not to let anyone down and not to disappoint the team at the Tour de France. But it looked to me as though he was putting a lot of pressure on himself. And on the other, and there he was sort of rooming with Alaphilippe, who to whom everything seems to come effortlessly, and the success at the Tour last year came effortlessly. And he was also at the same time being sort of adopted as this national sweetheart in France, and with a Midas touch. And I think that must have been really difficult for Jungels.
Well, he's very effervescent, yeah, Isn't he, Alaphilippe, whereas Jungels is far more kind of reserved. And so, you know, they must take all this into consideration when allocating rooms and putting people together in rooms and making sure they're compatible. They must know them, so they must believe they were compatible. And they do get on very well, don't they?
Well, I would imagine so. I mean, the thing, you know, Jungels would have been going back to his room every day, focusing on his performance. I mean, he did finish 11th. I mean, all right, 16 or so minutes down in the Tour, but, you know, not a terrible result by any means. But if your roommate is turning up every day with a fresh King of the Mountains jersey and another bouquet of flowers, you know, pretty tough to... It's such a, you know, such an individual event, the Tour de France, or, you know, as Francois says, a team sport practiced by individuals. If things aren't going well for you and your roommates having a wonderful time, I can imagine that would be difficult. But what the problem for Jungels, I think, is he is so talented and so versatile. I mean, there aren't many riders who can win a Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the style that he won it last year, which was impressive, who can just sort of say, you know, at the click of the fingers, oh, I'm going to go back and do the Cobble Classics, which I haven't done for years. But, you know, as part of a De Koninck Quickstep team, you know, this is not riding the Cobble Classics for, you know, I don't know, AG2R, or, you know, bad example. But, you know, this is for the team that will go into every single Cobble Classic expecting to get on the podium at least, and can go to the Giro and legitimately think of a top five finish. And in a way, De Koninck Quickstep, you know, for all we talk about how efficient they are at winning, you know, they perhaps don't need to put a lot of energy and specific effort into one particular rider like Bob Jungels when they know that others will more likely than not deliver as well. He's, you know, he's like being in a great Manchester United team of the past, back to that Alex Ferguson example again with Lefebvre. You know, he can play a role, but he can play all sorts of roles, and he's a sort of rider that too versatile perhaps for his own good,
and a bit of a luxury as well, maybe, because he's also, let's not forget, when they've had a sprinter, played an absolutely key role in leading out sprinters. I remember in particular with Gaviria at the 2017 Giro, there was a stage on Sardinia, I think, when there were crosswinds, and Jungels was absolutely immense that day, and then rode a very good race overall as well. So yeah, a huge talent, but what will the next few years look like for him? It remains to be seen.
And yet, Napalm, I understand that Lefebvre is absolutely determined and adamant to win the Tour de France with one of his riders before he calls it a day.
Yes, and as we'll hear in a friend special in, I think, a few weeks' time, actually, my conversation with Patrick Lefebvre, he's giving himself at least another couple of years. So time is running out if he wants to win the Tour.
Enric Maas this year, perhaps. My big tip this year is Yves Lampaert. I think he's going to have a big year.
Well, for the Tour de France, terrible. He's got no chance.
I think he's going
to get him off. Get the Scotsman off.
I think he's going to win the Tour of Flanders. There, I've said it. He's going to win the Tour of Flanders, Yves Lampaert.
Be funny now when he gets in a break on stage four of the tour and gains 53 minutes.
Well, we'll be digging this back out. We should wrap things up there, chaps. Before we go, a quick congratulations to Orla Shinawee, who as we speak has a new addition to the Shinawee family, a little baby boy born this morning. So congratulations to her and family. Wonderful news. And we should also remind you that our Friends of the Podcast program for 2019 is open for business. Thanks very much to everybody who signed up already as a friend. There are three audiobooks available to Friends of the Podcast. Four. One from the Giro, one from the Tour, one from the Vuelta, and one from the Women's Tour, read by Daniel, Lionel, myself, Orla, and Francois Tomzo. So they're available, and as I say, thanks very much to everybody who signed up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Very, very grateful to you for your support. And if you've supported us a little bit more with a bit of extra money, thank you for that. And you will also be able to submit some ideas for a special episode later in the year, of which you will be guest editor. So we'll be asking for ideas soonish. Our next friend special, I think, will be Yellow Lotto, who aren't called Lotto anymore, Jumbo Visma. I spent some time with them at their training camp before Christmas, and we'll hear from them, including Primoz Roglic and Stephen Kruijswijk. So that's coming up quite soon. But for the moment, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
First ever Pro Cycling Rep 2019. New season is coming soon. This is Astana Pro Team.
No somos solo un equipo, sino una gran familia.
I'm Vino. Behind me it's Martino.